Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back with a great show again tonight. This has been, I guess the fall of amazing topics, I guess we could call it that. Right, Sam?
Oh, certainly, yes.
It's
amazing
great.
Topics and amazing people.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've had a lot of issues, things come up, which is exactly what we wanted to cover in the show, is when topics came up and raised their head that we wanted to be able to jump in and talk about them, where we had things going on like hostile intruder incidents, and we had things going on like the Ebola stuff. And so, in the midst of all of that, we do want to cover some other topics. And Sam, we've got some good stuff going on tonight.
We do. Two of our favorite things are violent incident response and MCI, and we're going to talk about an MCI tonight. And we've got the full regalia tonight. We've got our friends Jim Logan and Joe Holly and my good friend Mike Marsh, who works from a company I previously worked in private ambulance, and he's going to talk some about his role in the Asiana crash and some good things that actually came out of that we may not have heard about. But first, I want to say hi to Joe. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Sam. Hi, Jamie, and welcome, Mike. We're glad to have you tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Jim, you're out there, too.
Hey, good evening. It's nice to talk about something other than Ebola.
Is it?
Amen.
I'm
really excited to talk to Mike about his experience with this airliner crash. A lot of things get lost in the media and the news. A lot of the good aspects of take-home points that happen. And so I guess we're going to talk about some of those things tonight.
Exactly. And Mike, you're like the rest of us. You're a multitasker. You have 100 different hats that you wear, and you've just gained some new ones, I'm happy to say.
I did.
Well, tell us about, and we're going to discuss some of the other things you do later, but tell us about what it is you do and what you're going to be doing.
Well, I serve as one of, I guess it's all changed today, hasn't it?
yes, it has.
I used to serve as the one of three paramedic captains that were assigned to the San Mateo American Medical Response Transport Division, and responsible for the 911 system, one of two exclusive operating areas within San Mateo County. And the San Francisco International Airport is in San Mateo County. So I happened to be on that day, and it was just a day that you look back and you hear in your world as you go through. That was a career event day. I could not have planned that day any better for my career. And I have been training to that day and training others. And when it finally happened, I really felt instantaneously I hadn't trained enough over 16 years.
Well, it's funny because we all think about and talk about the big one, but to be honest, few of us actually really experience it. And you got that opportunity. And I've heard some good things about it. Like Jim mentioned, there, some of the little details that our audience might be interested in knowing about aren't the things that go out through the social media or through the media, because nobody really cares but us. But that's what we want to talk about tonight. So walk us through that day. What were you doing and how did you get engaged in it? And kind of tell us what that was like.
Sure, not a problem. So my day started at 6 o'clock in the morning. We have shift change, and it was a day that that started like all of my days do. It was sunny. I had absolutely no issues with starting my computer. It connected immediately and awesomely. My dispatcher called me and said that they were having a great day and wished me a very good day. All my charge nurses at my receiving facilities wished me a great day as well, too. So all joking aside, it was just a normal day. I was in the last day of training a new paramedic captain that had just come on board. And that captain came to me and said, I really want to take my last day today. I feel like I'm going to be able to pass my skills and my last day of evaluation. I want to go solo. I said, sure, not a problem. So I sent our special ops coordinator home and get a good night's rest. I took the special ops coordinator's role that day and was just kind of out in the periphery as he, as this training captain was doing his last and final evaluation. I think just before 10 o'clock, I was having a cup of coffee with a crew and enjoying my morning. And we got a dispatch to a shooting call. And unfortunately, we responded to an incident in which we lost one of our own self-inflicted gunshot wound to one of our own police officers that is in that county. And we were driving up to the Mission Hospital and from San Francisco General Hospital. And I got the turnover care and, you know, delivering this patient to the ED staff and dealing with the fallout of that type of incident. And I walked out the door of the trauma bay. And I was just kind of just taking a breath for a second, and my pager goes off. And at that time, my radio starts toning, and it just kept going. There were just a lot of tones. And I looked down at my pager, and it said, alert 3, activation, SFO airport, large plane crash. Now, normally, you know, over the course of my 9 years in San Mateo County, you know, we get a lot of those kind of pages that just are alert activations, or this is a drill, or, you know, or it turns out to be kind of nothing. And I got up on the radio, and I asked dispatch, I said, confirming this is a drill, and they're like, that is negative. This is a large aircraft down. So I crest over, I grabbed the training captain who was coming to meet me and pick me up because I had rode in with the original crew with the officer. And we were coming over the hill, and I look over, I'm passing Candlestick heading southbound on 101, and I see this extremely large cloud of black smoke coming from San Francisco International Airport. And the radio was squawking all over the place. And I remember driving down 101 thinking to myself, this is it. This is the day that I have been training for, the large mass casualty incident. And I'm already behind the eight ball because I'm coming from a distance. That's kind of how my day started. And for there was a progression of events that happened, which I could talk to you, but I'm not, you know, you can ask me questions or where you want me to go with this. But I just also want to point out that if I were to take you through the day, I want to tell you from the very beginning that, you know, this event was not made because of my actions. This event was made because of everyone's actions that were involved in that day. And it glorified to me that it didn't matter what color the patch was on your shoulder, and it didn't matter whether you were private, public, airport crash rescue, suppression on a truck company from San Francisco Fire Department, or an engine company from San Mateo. Everyone worked together, and we were really bonded together because of the common ICS language and because of the years spent networking and training in the past before that day.
Well, that's two areas I want to touch on, Mike, and I know, Joe, you want to get in here, too. That's the really important piece I think we want to address is how did that happen? How did you work together, and how did you train together? But, Joe, you had a question.
No, I think you're definitely right on it, Sam. I was sort of interested in Mike's comments earlier that, you know, you do a lot of training, and then it sort of happens, and you feel like you didn't get enough. And I think that just – that's sort of something we've talked about on this podcast many times before, that for most folks, they get one of these in their entire career. And, you know, it is the training that makes the difference there. So I'm like you, I want to hear about sort of how ICS came together and how the organization began to put itself together from Mike. That'd be great.
Sure. Why don't you? Yeah, take us into that. What role were you in, and how did that interaction take place?
Absolutely. So we driving down 101. We're coming to a pre a pre-planned entry point for disasters or imminent or already crashes on the tarmac or inside the closed campus of SFO. And we responded to the North Access or North Field Checkpoint, which is near Signature Air. And we staged up there. And for the audiences, or I guess for the people listening to this podcast, is that you cannot enter onto a tarmac of an international airport or any airport for that matter without some type of safety officer escorting you. And funny, because during after action reports, we've always talked about, you know, if we had to move large amounts of ambulances and stuff like that, how would that work with this escorting process that goes into there? It eventually worked itself out and it was great. And they added a whole bunch of people, but there was, you know, there was movement issues that were really dependent upon the safety officers clearing a path. And thank God they were out there, because there were so many pieces of moving apparatus out there. So we arrived on we were immediately directed through the checkpoint, went to Fire Station 2, which was on the tarmac at SFO. I initially told the first unit on scene to immediately set up for ambulance staging. And Division 3 Chief Saragusa from San Francisco Fire Department arrived. Battalion Chief Charlie Berenger arrived from San Mateo County. We all kind of made a little huddle, and then we were escorted out to the crash site. Now, when I initially arrived onto the crash site on the tarmac, on the runway, I put myself in a position which I felt would allow for the pre-plan of the ambulances to go around me as kind of like the transport unit leader or the ground ambulance coordinator, so that I can make sure that I'm tracking the patients that are going in and out of there. What we had not realized at that point, or what I had not realized at that point in time, was that the tail section had created a whole nother division. The airport is very large, and it was very long, and it was just a huge tarmac. And so I assigned another quick response vehicle. It was actually our San Mateo mental health response technician, our smart car medic, that I assigned in the QRB to head down to the tail section. And quickly I found myself and my span of control growing to an unmanageable level. So I placed the smart car medic in one group as a medical group. I placed another medic as far as the medical group goes at the crash site. And then we were moving the green patients via bus after the initial triage. We were moving the minor green patients over to gate 91, which was a third medical group. And I looked up and I was like, man, I've got a lot of people reporting to me. I'm going to have to break off of a group and go to a branch. And when I made the branch, I noticed that I had my group supervisors were both AMR and were San Francisco Fire. And in order to communicate to those people, I used a rescue captain, Stuart Beach, from San Francisco Fire. He stood next to me, and I stood next to him, and we had a couple of chief's assistants that had come down from the city, and they were tallying, and we were making decisions on polling and working together on communication, and we were stood right next to each other. And in that medical branch, Stuart Beach and myself, became kind of a unified medical branch. And I don't even know if that even exists in the FOG manual, but that's what we became. And as those initial critical or red patients were taken off of the tarmac, we then decided to reset and replace all the EMS transport units back into Station 2 staging. The suppression activities and the investigation activities and law enforcement activities were continuing on the tarmac. And we looked at each other and said, okay, now we've got another 200 some odd patients that are still at gate 91 that need to be re-triaged again, and we're going to need to make some final destination decisions for transportation. So we remounted all everyone up, got into a little single file line, went over to gate 91, rinsed, washed, and repeated the whole process again. And we just reassigned transport unit leaders and medical group supervisors and ground ambulance coordinators. And then, of course, the strongest point that I would tell you that really held us together for the days and the months and probably the years afterwards that really helped us out was we had a medical communications unit leader that was an incident dispatch technician from our county communications center that stood next to me typing in this triage tag numbers and the destinations and the medical mutual aid assets that were coming in and keeping this stuff on track real time. So that's kind of the 1,000-foot view of what happened that day as far as the error chart.
So, Mike, how long did it take you to get all the reds out of there?
It was just around about an hour or so, I would say, and I don't have my notes right in front of me, but it was just about an hour that 100% of the red patients were red or critical patients were immediately taken to trauma centers.
That's amazing. And you said you had two casualty collection points?
We had a tail section casualty collection point.
Okay.
We had the ground zero crash point, and then we had gate 91's casualty collection point.
So I know Jim and Joe have questions.
Yeah, this is Jim. Can you just kind of run through maybe two things? First, your acuity levels. How many reds, yellow, green, black tag, according to smart triage? And I'm assuming that you use smart instead of salt, because that's kind of what's going on right now.
Correct. So we use start triage, but the hospitals, the two trauma hospitals we transported to, use salt. We initially on site had the initial morgue patient on the site of ground zero, and we had another one that was on site, and then one to come to injuries later on at the hospital. We had over 40 or so reds, and then we had probably, I want to say it was 80. No, I think it was 40-something reds, and then we had something around 30 to 60 yellows delayed, and then the rest were green. Some were upgraded, some were downgraded. But the keynote was, once we triaged them and then re-triaged them, once they went into the back of the ambulance with whatever acuity level that they were at, once they got to the end destination hospital, there were no transfers out, based off of having to upgrade them or downgrade them to different centers. So they were very well triaged according to start, on the time of the event.
Yeah, so that's kind of an interesting issue that you guys kind of got a mixed triage system, and that's becoming more commonplace too, as you know, the CDC and the military, and we all try to transition to this standardization of SALT. Do you find that difficult to deal with the hospitals at all, or are you guys going towards the SALT in the future, and just kind of saying we'll start right now?
You know, it's not, it's definitely, to me, and I'm probably one of the more aggressive, MCI responders, in the county, and definitely do a lot of after action reports. And I have found that, the interface, from us to the hospital is, it goes extremely well. I've never seen there be any type of delay. At all. The only delays I've ever seen regarding our triaging is when they get so many patients that it tends to delay them, just because of just the sheer numbers. However, on that day, these two trauma centers, Sanford Medical Center and San Francisco General Hospital, went full tilt. When we made our initial radio report to the hospital saying we're declaring a co-triage major, these guys stood up the world in tents outside in their parking lot.
Yeah, you're talking about two of the best trauma centers in the country, I think. So you were lucky. Jim, you had another thought?
Yeah, just one more thing, and I'll be quiet for just a second. You mentioned entering triage tag numbers. Are you guys, and just for the listeners out there, there's you know, many ways that can be done manually, electronically. So one thing that we took back from Katrina was electronic patient tracking, and that's one thing we've instituted with our department and with our jurisdiction, and others have too. Is that something you guys have the capability of? Is sharing that information in real time? I know you mentioned that. So can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. So the we at that point in time we used the DMS triage system, EMT 3 ribbon system, as well as the EMT 3 command boards that we have in the county. The ribboning system went great. Then we got them into the casualty collection points, and then they, of course they bought their tags, and once they bought their tags, they bought the number. And then we inputted that number into our CAD-based system. As far as the barcode scanners, at that time we were not set up to do the barcode scanners. We're looking at some products. There was a DMS, you know, like a handgun that you get at, like, you know, a supermarket, you know, to scan your barcodes. That works well when you haven't run one of these events. So the funny part about it was that you know, we have this wonderful scanner gun that we can go around, but it's attached to the computer that the dispatcher is using at the command post to enter the information in, and doesn't have a 200-foot cord to go around and get the patients as they're coming in and out at the transport unit leader or the ground ambulance coordinator's position. So we have learned that, you know, as we're moving forward, we're exploring options of the handheld device scanning options that can be run off of Android or an iPhone.
So just exactly. So we're a little bit different. We have the tethered scanners as well. If we're going to do like immunizations for a department, or doing a point of dispensing for the health department, or just sheltering operations, that works really good. But you're exactly right. If you're running an MCI, it's not so great. There are handheld scanners, but the trouble with the handheld scanners is just that we're not used to using them in EMS or healthcare. Unlike the folks at the supermarket who's doing inventory, the keypad is totally different. So the new thing is what you mentioned, is you know, using something you're used to, and that's your iPhone. And so those applications are starting to become more commonplace. So just for the listeners out there, there's a way to collect that information, and again, lessons learned from disasters and experiences since then, is that it's a system that has to be tweaked a little bit more, but I think we're almost there and getting information pretty fast, when you say.
Yeah, and on that note, we're doing a lot more with electronic data collection on the federal level, which I'm sure Joe can attest to less so than we are in the DMET. But we do barcode scanning. Everything is attached to that patient's barcode, and that's been really helpful. But I think you two need to have a nice long discussion when we get to Nashville. But Joe, you've been kind of quiet. Do you have any questions for Mike?
Well, Jim touched on a couple of things that I was quite interested in, and he and I think very much alike, so those questions got covered. I am actually curious to know, though, just a couple of things. Mike, did you have any physicians respond to the scene? And if you did, were these EMS folks or other? What did you do with them? Were they in the way, or were they beneficial to you? And looking back on it, was there something else along those lines that would have been helpful to you?
So yes, we had a physician on scene, and I handed him my standard my laminated card that says, read this, doctor, and you're taking all responsibility all the way to the hospital. And he ran screaming. No, I'm just kidding.
that usually happens, actually.
It does.
I will tell you that I have had the honor over my 16 years in EMS to gather a large networking of clinicians and clinically excellent people that are out there. Prior to this event, I had worked side by side with Dr. Ye, the San Francisco medical director for the fire department, medical director.
Yeah, I know him well. He's awesome.
Yes. And Clement and I knew each other from the Giants 2012 celebration. Go Giants. And I also knew him. I also, when he walked out of gate 91, and there are no dramatics here, I'm being very, very honest with you, he came down the freight elevator at gate 91. I'm walking up to the gate and the doors open up and we looked at each other and both of us went, holy superlative, enter there. I'm really glad you're here. And he says, I said the same thing. I'm like, great. Can you go upstairs and clear all the C-spines so that I don't have to transport them?
Beautiful.
So, but the honest question is yes. And he did play a great role. And here are the three areas in which Dr. Ye played an amazing role for me as a medical branch officer. One, doctor talking to doctors. You guys speak a language that I swear is like me talking to my wife about shopping. I don't understand it. There's that. And when I started having some issues with destination decisions, when the EOCs were getting involved and whatnot, and we were talking to Dr. Brown at San Francisco General Hospital, we were working in a way where we were very much honoring our two parallel MCI plans that were both working at the same time. I know that sounds funny, but we can get into that later. We had two parallel MCI plans running at the same time. And when EOC said that that we weren't going to send any more patients to San Francisco General Hospital, the ability to place a medical doctor on the phone making destination decisions with these receiving facilities to make sure that they could handle these patients was priceless. And that's the first point. The second point of having a medical director on scene is there were some complex medical legal issues on scene that we had a physician right there to help navigate those issues. And the third is medics work really well in battle, and we work amazing under pressure because that's just the kind of the crackheads we are. But it is nice to know that you have a doctor standing right there in this chaotic environment backing you up. And so I am now a huge advocate. If you're going to start running a large MCI, you should have an auto dispatch medical director or some type of MD that's on site. Because if nothing more than to open up an additional care site or work the green zone like a clinic, because you're just hammered with reds and yellows, then that's great. Then they're able to do that. We were very fortunate that out of the 53 patients transported to San Francisco General Hospital and the 56 that were transported to Stanford, many of those met a timeline that would not have involved an MD. But when we got to the greens and the yellows that had been there, that re-triaging, that musculoskeletal type of pain that was cropping up, there was a lot of conversations that happened that were very beneficial for us to have an MD on team.
And I might throw in there, Joe, just for you, that Dr. Brown at SF General is a DMAT doc. He's on my team. So he is firmly entrenched in the world of disaster. And what you're saying, Mike, make perfect sense. If you got the right docs, and obviously you did. That guy that ran away screaming, not so much.
That was just a story.
Yeah. But I know Jamie's probably sitting back there going, all right, you guys, shut up. We could definitely go on forever about this. This is awesome. But the last point I want to touch on is you talked about, obviously, you were very well prepared for this. The hospitals were very well prepared for this. What kind of training, and I know SFO, like all airports, probably does their own internal training. I've been privy to some of the big events that they do there. But how, in general, do you feel, what kind of training do you do that made this work so excellently?
So for AMR San Mateo County, we are blessed with a command staff that really supports our disaster response team and which is our special operations unit, and we have some great, amazing people on that team that made this day very successful. On top of all of the 911 providers on the ambulances that day. That were out there, we all did well. But the gift that we have is the disaster response or the special operations unit in San Mateo County trains on a monthly, bi-monthly side for the tactical medicine portion that we have, which I'm hearing we're going to be talking about later. But we also have a disaster response team side that drills on ICS. And each one of these operators that are on the special ops unit are ICS 100, 200, 700, 800. Most already have 300 and 400 based off of class availability. We talk about trauma triage. We run trauma triage all the time. They know the ins and outs of our MCI plan. And we also have the California State Disaster Medical Services Unit in our operation 137, and that unit comes with a whole mess of equipment, and you know once a year we pull all that equipment out, every single bin, and we go through it and we ask and we talk, and so when the day happens we know where that equipment is, we know how to access it. That unit sits on a response algorithm that is dispatched automatically in accordance to our MCI plan. And we sit and we train and and the other big thing as well, Sam, is that every single MCI or expanded medical event that San Mateo runs in its county is 100% audited. And it is a private-public partnership audit. And the fire departments and AMR and PSC, the public safety communications, we all get together and we review these cases and we find out how we can do better from EM systems, hospital polling, you know, the reports and how timely the hospitals were getting back to us with their polling, to the initial scene size up, to the interoperability of ICS and the privates working with the publics and the publics working for the privates. And nothing glorified that more for me in the training of it doesn't matter who you are under ICS, it's how you can do it with a good efficiency and experience. The EMS staging officer was the battalion chief for a fire department, and the private medic, me, was the EMS branch officer. It didn't matter that day who signed your check. It mattered by, you know, could you do the role when you got there and what position you assumed, and it didn't matter. No one complained because we all did a great job. And so in short, and I'll add just one last little piece on there, is that when these special operations unit medics and EMTs that are out there and they train, they can't help but talk about it in the truck or the ambulance with their partners that are not a part of the team. And so by osmosis and diffusion and pure Ricky Rescueism, we learn from one another by doing it, rinsing it, repeating it, and learning from what we've done. And I could not be more proud of the AMR San Mateo team that day.
I would agree. This it's so nice to hear that it can work if you get the right people and the right training. And, of course, that's what you guys do at Paragon. Jim and Joe do. We'll have to talk more about that when we see you in Nashville. Jamie, we're going to give you a chance to pop out here. You've been sitting in the background.
And rightly so, because this has been a fascinating topic. And, you know, Mike, I'd just like to add in my 2 cents worth, you know, from our end of things. I think you guys are a credit just listening to the response and everything you all did, a credit to EMS and what we do. And so, you know, I appreciate that. And just letting the disaster experts kind of cue in here and talk to you, you know, and one thing that leapt out at me was that when you said, you know, this is a once in a lifetime event, your career event that is going to occur. And we talk with Jim and Joe a lot about that when we talk about what they do with Paragon Medical Education Group. And, you know, Joe, you and Jim have talked about that very thing, that you know you got to prepare for that, but with the proper training. And it sounds like Mike had their team with their whole group, the way they were training in San Mateo County to prepare for this event, they were ready for it because of the type of experiential and regular training they did.
Well, thanks
very much.
I think you're exactly right, and Mike, kudos to you and your people, AMR, and your system in general. You guys clearly did a stellar job with a really difficult and challenging situation, and my hat's off to you. It warms my heart in many ways to hear that the time spent on training, ICS, the approach that you took, the involvement of the people that you have, and how you guys work together are clearly the factors that make those horrible scenes functional and the response to be rapid, efficient, and appropriate in so many ways. And it's a good feeling to me to know that the stuff that we're teaching people bears itself out in your testimony that you basically gave tonight about many of the things that we've talked about in this podcast before, and knowing that you know the kind of stuff that we're focusing on really is the stuff that people remember, and it's the stuff that makes a difference on the scene for a mass casualty incident, a disaster, or any large scale scene at all. So again, kudos to you and your entire system for a job well done.
Well, Joe, I'd like to wrap up here, and as we roll on out, where can folks find you and Jim?
Well, they can find us on the web at ParagonMedicalGroup.com and also on Facebook under the same handle. And we're always here on the Disaster Podcast, and we're on Twitter at ParagonMedEBU.
And Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, at the usual social media places, Sam Bradley on Facebook, Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter. And I failed to mention to Mike, we might have lost him, but I will let him know that people can make comments. I'm sure maybe some good discussion or some good comments can come out of this, some good questions. So please pop into the website and make those questions. I'm sure Mike would be more than glad to answer some of them for you. And I can see that Jim and Mike can have a very interesting conversation about disaster preparedness when we get into Nashville. But where do they find you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media sites out there, so look me up. Of course, over at MedicCast.com with all of my various podcasts, including the Disaster Podcast, but most importantly at DisasterPodcast.com, where we hope you continue to enjoy getting these shows and having us bring you these regular programs with special thanks to the folks at Paragon Medical Education Group, because we couldn't do this show without you guys, Joe and Jim, and we do appreciate that.
That's our pleasure.
Well, sir, indeed it is.
So, this is really one of those situations. We talk a lot about disaster medicine, but, you know, this is certainly not the average ambulance call for EMS responder.
Boy, that's a fact. And like you said, it's when you go into this thing, Mike went into this, but he went into it feeling good. He went into it knowing that I can do this. All the training that we've done with these agencies is now going to work. And it did. From starting out that day, I mean, the whole day started for him like a pretty good luck day. Everybody was positive and upbeat and the sun was shining. And you just had to know that even though this disaster occurred, it was going to go as well as it possibly could on the ICS side. And it did. And I didn't know all these details before now, and I'm really proud of that bunch, and I'm really glad Mike's coming to my county now. He could spread some of that love in Contra Costa.
So, Sam, why don't you close us out, and we'll get this show done.
Well, this is a very good example of the fact that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.